Position number 22123, wheel 7.
Maybury Rail 7.
And yes, we would follow these lines through. And on one occasion, I was following the line through, and lo and behold, roaming around in front of us was a young deer. And most of these large animals, I mean, they wouldn't come anywhere near the fighting because of the noise. But this young deer was just calmly chewing the cud there. So we thought it would be great to enhance our rations. So the idea was to shoot it, and never thinking about the repercussions. And we, at least one of the infantry guys, I didn't have a weapon with me at that time, he took an aim and missed, and took another shot and missed again, and the deer was gone. When we got back to the regiment, we found the whole position was all standing too, because these shots had been heard, and people thought that there was a minor firefight going on down there. Again, knuckles wrapped, and again, lessons learned. Another lesson I learned, not to interfere with military practice, was again after the time when our position was virtually overrun. Talking to some of the guys that were down at the real sharp end, they were saying that they just couldn't get enough grenades away in time. By the time they got grenades out of their boxes and pulled the pins and thrown them, you were talking of quite a tens of seconds, and that could have been the difference between life and death. So I came up with this marvellous principle of why don't we just take all the pins out of the grenades, have them all armed up, and turn the grenades round in the boxes so that the levers were jammed up against the wooden portion of the box, because the grenade boxes were all in partitioned off, so that each grenade had its own little partition. But you could turn it around, turn the grenade around, so that the lever would jam up against the side of the partition. And we did have a chance a few nights later to exercise what this was all about. And the Chinese would come up, and you'd take a whole box of these things and just heave them over the parapet. And of course, it was like a young bomb going off, and it was pretty effective. What I hadn't thought of, though, was when we left the position, what would happen to the regiment taking over from us, because the first thing that you ever did was to do a complete audit of the assets that were being left behind. You checked all the radio sets, if there were radio sets left behind. You checked hand grenades, etc. All the arms, the ammunition, you would check. Whatever was left, you'd check to make sure what you'd got was what you expected to have. And I didn't think, of course, that what would happen with the hand grenades, that the guys would just open the boxes and tip them out on the floor to count them and put them back in again. And I'd left them, or we had left them, with the pins out and the all jammed in the boxes ready for action. Luckily nobody got killed, but I was told to keep my inventive mind to myself. And other things I used to try and do, for instance, was one of the Chinese weapon, the standard short-range infantry weapon, was something we called a burp gun, because when it fired at a very, very rapid rate, and it sounded just like a burp, a burp, and that was it. And our Sten guns, I thought, well, maybe we can enhance these a bit. So I, by massaging various spring strength in the magazines and in the breech, behind the breech block, I managed to actually up the rate of fire quite significantly of a Sten gun. But the only problem was that the barrels wouldn't handle it, and they would, after a number of attempts, I found that the barrels were just peeling back like bananas. And I got into trouble with the armourers over that. So My career as an inventor in the army, I don't think was particularly fortuitous. Winter time, I think, should dwell a little bit on the winter there. For most of us, it was not a very good period at all. We'd never been subjected to temperatures of like minus 20 at midday, etc., etc. Although the kit we had was pretty good, it was excellent kit. Rumour had it that it was the same sort of kit that had been specifically designed for mountaineering purposes, and Hunt had actually used the same sort of kit for climbing Everest with. And it consisted, as I remember, of long johns, string vests, silk vests to go over top of the string vests, standard army shirt, pullovers, and excellent waterproof clothing. And what was even more remarkable, considering the problems that they had in the Falklands, was superb boots. Very, very good boots, again with thermal liners in the base of them. And the pièce de résistance was a parka, which one could put over the whole lot of all this. And the parka had a hood with a soft wire frame to the face piece, so you could actually squash it all up to go down to a little slit. And there were many, many problems that we suffered in the winter. As signalers, we found that batteries would have a quarter of their lifespan, just lose their energy. And so poor guys on patrols, they had to take two or three times more batteries than they would normally use. And if you were sort of standing too anywhere, you had to be careful that, one guy actually was standing too with his face resting on his gun, and the metal part of it froze onto his cheek. So he tried to pull it off and ripped half his cheek off. All these stupid little things that were happening. And one of the more useful pieces of kit that we had supplied to us was self-heating drinks and soups. It was a can with a fuse in the top, and had a tip to it. When you sort of took the seal off, that provided a striker, rubbed it up against the fuse, and the fuse went all the way down inside the fluid, whatever it was. Cocoa was superb, coffee, soups, and boil it all up. The only thing you had to remember, of course, was to puncture the can, otherwise it would as it heated up, it would expand and explode. And we had quite a number of minor casualties through that, because the pet trick was to tuck these things inside of your jacket to keep yourselves warm. Patrols, once the snow had hit the ground, patrols would inevitably get the snow parkas to go out with, and that was another layer of warmth, because it was a terrible thing to go out on patrol. But certainly if you were going out on patrol to just lie and listen and wait with those sort of temperatures erupt around you. Again, I think the Canadian troops took to that far easier than we did, because that's a natural environment for them in the winter, and they were much more used to that. We didn't like it very much, and the Aussies had a particular rough time with it, but nobody enjoyed the winter. The ground became so hard that you couldn't do anything with it, you couldn't dig it or anything like that. I found my explosives course that I'd had with the SAS was excellent, because I used to be able to get the plastic explosives and blow holes in the ground or anywhere I needed to. Much easier than digging, as I say, you couldn't really dig. Consequence again of cold, when we were out of the line, we were allowed a beer ration, and I found a whole crate of beer that hadn't been opened, and all the bottles were smashed because of the beer had frozen and expanded and broken the glass. But in the bottom of each glass was some fluid which hadn't frozen, which was the alcohol. So we found that we used to be able to get some pretty good small quantities of alcohol out of the beer by letting it all freeze. The general condition, I think, in the winter was quite different from the summer. For a start, when you were in the line, there was no real washing facilities or anything like that. And in fact, it was too cold to do anything. So basically, you went into the line with a clean set of kit, and you came out after a month smelling like a very ripe farmyard, I think is the best way to say it. And nobody took any kit off or anything like that. Even to go to the loo, you might drop your outer slacks, but the long johns had a flap in the back. And the length of time that you had all this off was as brief as you could make it. Again, injuries used to arrive in the most unusual situations. Popularly became known as zip dick, because guys would go for a pee, they would unzip their outer clothing and zip it up again as fast as possible, and very often catch the member in the zip. And there was only one way we found you could get out of that, and that was to get somebody to grab hold of the zip and give it a yank to undo it again. Screams of pain. The other thing that I found, which was a forecast, I think, of the future, certainly as far as the American forces were concerned, most of us in the British forces, all had a wound pack, a morphine pack. We used to have, I think it was called field dressing pack. And there was various small bandages in there, a large wad bandage to take care of large wounds, and a couple of vials of morphine, which we used to be able to, most of us have been instructed on how to do this, and put a mark an M on the casualty's forehead if he'd had morphine. And found certainly when we were out of the line that we used to be approached very, very often by Americans to sell our morphine. So even in those days, there was a drug problem with the Americans. I was never aware of any of that happening with, certainly nobody I knew had any problems like that. I don't think we even thought about it.
Did anybody sell them it?
Not that I know of, no. We were just curious as to why they wanted it. We assumed, I think we were sufficiently naive at the time, at least initially, to assume that they weren't issued with it, as we were. The one thing that we used to try and trade, though, with them, they used to have a superb mortar site for a 3-inch mortar that we didn't have, and we found that we could do all sorts of wheeling and dealing with them to trade for kit. And our mortar guys were always sort of exchanging crates of this self-heating soup and whatever for a mortar site, because theirs were much more accurate than ours. Now the end of the war came around about, I think it was July, I can't remember the precise date, but I know I was being detailed off to come home. My time was up, and I know I'd left the regiment. I got back into some holding area where we were all going off to Pusan, and the Chinese again decided that just I mean, the ceasefire and everything had all been agreed, but they decided that they would put one last throw into capturing the infamous position known as the Hook, and so they assaulted the position and took it over, and the Durhams were were officially in reserve behind that position, and it was their job to retake it if possible. And I believe there was there was a conference between the divisional commander and Colonel Jeffries, the CO of the Durhams, that within another sort of N hours, it's all going to finish. Do you want to retake the position? And I believe Jeffries was courageous enough to say no, he wasn't going to risk any more lives, you know, not when the ceasefire was so near at hand. And so they didn't go back in. But a number of us who were leaving from the Durhams at the time in this holding area, we were told to get all our kit together because we were going back into the line. And I remember standing up, making some expletive or other, and saying, I'm buggered if I'm going back there. Only to be suddenly confronted by some medical corporal with a rifle aiming it straight at me, and he said, you're going back there or you'll get shot. And I said, what are you talking about? I'm only joking. And he said, no, you're not. He said, I'm going to shoot you. He said, you've had a direct order. He said, you're going back to the line. There's somebody else just behind him, thankfully, because I think he actually meant it. Belted him across the back of the head with a gun. His rifle did go off, but it wasn't no longer pointed at me. The bullet went out through the top of the tent. And I think that was my very last piece of action. A most weird situation, because had I had to have gone back, of course I would have gone back, but you know, just on the spur of the moment, I said, oh, I'm not going back there. So we eventually got to a boat, got on the boat, went back to from Pusan to Japan. And my fond memory of that was that looking out the back of the boat was a whole trail of bobbing steel helmets. Everybody was throwing their steel helmets off the boat. And for the Brits, this was most amusing, because the Brits never wore steel helmets. There wasn't a single Brit soldier that I ever came across that ever wore a steel helmet in or out of the line. And so that's how much we thought of them. A quick burst on Japan. The ship that we were designated to come home on was commandeered for the POWs who'd been released. They came off in two batches. The most severely invalided people came first, real casualties, and they went off on this one boat. There were still more POWs to come, and so the boat was, the second boat, which was the Asturias, was held up so that we could get on it with the remnants of the POWs. And whilst I was in Japan, I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki to see the results of the atom bomb attacks. And although I eventually worked on nuclear weapons, I did find the devastation there rather horrendous. And to see some of the sights, it was unbelievable. The other experience I had there was my first earthquake. I'd never experienced an earthquake before. And I don't know why. I always used to think earthquakes went up and down, but I suddenly found, of course, they went from side to side. And there was quite a strong one whilst we were there, and I remember sort of, I couldn't stand up while it was going on, but luckily enough, I was in the middle of a square with no buildings around, so I didn't get hurt. Then we eventually did come home, came home on the Asturias. I don't think there was anything untoward. Had a nice tour of Hong Kong again. Met up with some old SAS colleagues in Singapore as we came through. And then eventually got back to the UK. I was a couple of months late in being discharged. And God bless the military, they did come up trumps. They gave me a huge, in those days, financial compensation for being late for discharge. And I quietly went back into civilian life. Thankful very much for the experience, and thankful that I came out of it unscarred. And unlike quite a lot of people, it certainly changed my life, but I think it changed my life for the better. Because I actually began to appreciate more about what life was all about. I'd nearly lost it once or twice. And I always think that's it makes you appreciate what you've got. I appreciated learning about other people. I think I got an insight into different people, different ways of looking at things, which stood me in good stead later on in my life. Yes, there was one occasion when, again, I was repairing telephone communication with a regiment to our left, and there was a known airstrike going in by the Americans on that day. So all the right air recognition panels were laid out on the ground, and to our horror, the Americans actually dropped napalm all over the wrong position. And I was about a quarter of a mile away, I think, from when it happened. And it was a very frightening experience. The one thing that hadn't dawned on me prior to that, I'd never even given it a thought, was actually what happens with an napalm attack is that, because all the air gets burnt where the conflagration takes place, and so there's virtually a huge vacuum set up. And you suddenly find yourself with being drawn in almost like a huge gale in towards where the detonation took place. And so every time I see anything like this now, I can appreciate what a fearsome weapon napalm is. Okay.